Bienvenidos a Data Latam, donde exploramos la industria de datos en Latinoamérica.
Muy buenas, Franz, ¿cómo estás?
Muy buenas, Diego. Muy bien, muchas gracias. ¿Tú cómo estás?
Muy bien, energizado, como se puede ver con el saludo. Pero sí, llegando ya en noviembre al final del año.
Qué susto, ¿no?
Cuán rápido pasó.
Sí, yo por ahí a mediados de febrero siempre le digo al equipo que ya casi se va a acabar el año y vea que es verdad.
Sí, no pasó nada desde febrero.
No pasó hasta nada y ya estamos aquí.
Bueno, ¿qué querías comentar? A ver, tenías algo importante que mencionar.
Sí, yo quiero mencionar de que ya casi sale un blog post en el website de Xpantia que va a resumir una serie de videos, de demos que hice a solicitud de AMD. Ellos se acercaron a nosotros para ver si podíamos poner uno de sus CPUs en laptop, el Ryzen 7, y experimentar a ver cómo le funciona a alguien como yo que trabaja mucho con datos. Entonces hice tres experimentos de cómo funciona en movimiento, recompilamos R para sacar el máximo provecho al CPU, trabajamos con Kubernetes, trabajamos con LLMs. Todos esos están en videos en LinkedIn y los voy a resumir ahí. Cuando salga, podemos inclusive poner el eslabón aquí debajo del resumen de este podcast.
Eslabón para todos es el link. Pero me encanta como lo dice Franz, la traducción es buenísima, buenísimo. No, pero genial, buenísimo, Franz. Qué bueno que pudiste hacer eso con AMD y hacer experimentos que sé que te gusta y es de valor. Bueno, pero con eso, y ahora sí, pasando al podcast de hoy, vamos a hablar ahora en inglés un ratito. Vamos a estar con Josiah Parry. Welcome, Josiah, to Data Latam.
Thank you so much for having me. That was very fun to listen to.
Did you have Spanish in school?
I took French when I was younger, and then I got really into learning French in college, and then I had to learn another language to get my degree, or at least take a couple courses. And I was like, all right, I should just learn Spanish. I grew up in California. I should have known in the first place. Yeah. And it was the hardest thing ever, because every time I'd learn something, a conjugation or something, it would the previous years of French would just get in my way. So I got like two D's in my Spanish classes. I don't know any Spanish, but I picked up that you were talking about AMD cards and testing with Kubernetes and LLMs and all that fun stuff. But I wish I'd learned much I spoke.
You would do much better than a D right now.
Okay, Josiah, just for the audience to get to understand who you are and where you are. Where are you located right now? In
yeah, I am located in rainy Seattle. I just moved here a little bit over a year ago, but I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Well, fantastic, fantastic. And then the other quick question before we dive into talking to you about your stories, what is it that you are actually doing today? Which role in which company?
So today I work at a company called Esri. We build geospatial software. Specifically, I'm on our spatial analytics and data science team. Within that, I'm on our spatial statistics team. So I work with a bunch of people who think about how does place relate to data? So how do we help understand our data, but in relation to geographic space? It's really fun. I get to just think about really silly problems and read papers all day. And then the other part of that is I help lead a project called the ArcGIS Bridge, which is really just focused on bringing the ArcGIS ecosystem, which is kind of like all of our products combined, to the R ecosystem and vice versa. So really focused on how we can kind of harness R with our products and then our products with R in that way.
And in that line, I know that Franz has plenty technical questions that he wants to ask. But before we get there, what I want the audience to know is a little bit about your story. So I'll destroy your story by just going through LinkedIn, but with the objective that then you can really put it together.
Yeah.
So it looks like you studied sociology between 2014 and 2017. Wow, that's cool. I was going to study sociology at some point. Then I got into engineering. But then you said, oh, no. Urban informatics is my thing. So you did a Master of Science in between 2018 and 2020. And throughout and after that, probably you've been a lecturer at Northeastern University. Then you worked with our studio, now POSIT, for almost 3 years. Then you were a research analyst with the NPD group for about a year. Now you are a vice chair of the Infrastructure Steering Committee at the ARC Consortium, as well as what you just mentioned about ESRI, right, or ESRI.
Yeah.
What is wrong there? How do they expand, make it fun? Because I just...
Yeah, it's the way I got here. I think that people who start in social science and end up in data science kind of have a similar story. I studied sociology in undergrad, and we learned about all these really cool social theories and how people interact with social systems and structures. But then I remember being in like my second year wondering, how do we actually like know about, like, how do we confirm these things? And my uncle, who lived just 10 minutes away from where I went to college, he worked for IBM. And he was always telling me in the car when I'm hanging out with him, you got to learn this thing called R. It is so cool. It's a really cool programming language that helps you analyze and study things. And then I'm in my regression analysis class because we have to learn how to do regressions to understand social data. And my professor at the time shouts out Eric Laflamme, you rock. And he pulls up the R console, just like literally the R GUI and what comes out of the box, no R Studio, and starts like simulating data and doing stuff. And I'm like, oh, is that R? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. So from then on, I would be in the back of my anthropology classes or whatever, just like teaching myself R and programming, sitting in the hallways, programming in R. And then I got really down that rabbit hole, and I started listening to fun podcasts, like Partially Derivative. I wish they'd bring that one back, and Not So Standard Deviations. I really got into that world, and I thought it was really fun. So I was teaching myself all this, like machine learning and advanced statistics on the side, while being able to take my normal classes and supplement it. And through that, I also got into like GIS, like census tracts, these are places and they have social data associated with it. How do we understand that related to space too? So that's how I got there. And then I wanted to go to grad school to kind of mix the two things. So urban informatics is really like, how do we use big data to help understand cities? And that is like naturally a social problem, but also we're using big data from like 311, 911 calls, et cetera, to help understand these theories that we know so much about. And during that time, I'm still an R nerd. I'm getting better and better. And I decided I wanted to try to present at a USAR meetup in Boston. And that's when I met Rachel Dempsey, who you all probably know. Rachel Dempsey. She's awesome. She works at NowPosit and has forever. She said, have you ever thought about working in our studio? And I said, absolutely not. What do you mean? And she kind of guided me to the application process, and I ended up working there for 3 years while I finished my master's degree, which was a super informative point in my life. And I'm forever in debt to Rachel for that. And then after that, I kind of wanted to do something more applied, and I really got into geospatial statistics during the pandemic, and I kind of wanted to transition out of that work and eventually found myself at ESRI.
Fantastic. Quick thing that not even France knows. I wanted to study sociology just because of the Foundation and Empire trilogy from Asimov. Do you remember the psychohistory and this idea of being able to predict the long-term
future? Out into the future.
I've
been watching that show, and I've been thinking I need to go and read the books. The Isaac Asimov books, because it seems like someone took the idea of quantitative social science and just really extrapolated.
That was why I said, oh, sociology is so awesome. It's the closest to psychohistory that I could get in this world. But yeah, that's for another episode. Now, let's get more technical. Franz, Josiah, I learned here, so go for it.
Yeah, I think we can just start, Josiah, with just introduce what you do at ESRI, right? Because there's a lot of things, but why is that relevant, and why is that so much fun? That's what you started out with.
Yeah. First and foremost, anything I say just represents myself and not ESRI. I want to make sure I get that point clear.
Understood.
So at work, there's like two different aspects to it, right? So there's the more like hard math kind of spatial statistics side of things, and then there's an R side of things. And I tend to like shift between the two depending on what time of year it is. And right now I'm really in the focusing on spatial statistics side of things. So right now, like, we're really interested in how can we apply machine learning and deep learning technologies to space, and how can we kind of do prediction with spatial data while respecting the constraints that space puts on things, right? Like, we have to be analyzing data in regard to its physical space. Like, we have a location here. It's related to the locations around it. There's something called Tobler's first law of geography, which Roger Bevan so aptly wrote in one of his books, that it is not a law, it is a heuristic, which basically says that all things are related, but nearer things are more related. So our tools are really focused on how do we quantify that and how do we analyze that.
So one of the things that you know, I'm really curious about is, how do you see in this whole wave of LLMs, you know, one of the things that you hear often is, well, you know, LLMs cannot calculate, and that's true, they're large language models, but they can generate SQLs. So, you know, with a little bit of a backdoor, you can actually do interesting things. How is spatial data moving in or around or about that generative AI space? What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's really hard. I think there's the skeptic side of me, which is, I use LLMs all day for programming and stuff, but for analysis, I definitely don't trust it. And I think a lot of people on my team were like, how do we approach this in a way that is helpful, informative, helps you do your analysis, but leaves the interpretation to the human, right? Like, I think that's kind of where we're at. And I think a lot of the discussion has been really on, initially, it's like, how do we use LLMs to analyze and understand our data? But I think a lot of the discourse has really shifted from that, because we're realizing that, like, we shouldn't be trusting, you know, models that are trained on Wikipedia and Reddit posts to make conclusions about our data. But these things are really good if you feed them documentation and you can tell them, you know, here are the tools that we have in our toolkit. This is what they're supposed to do. And here's how you can possibly chain these things together, right? So I think we're starting to think about, okay, well, we have this large, you know, corpus of data on spatial analysis and techniques and tools and how they might be used together. So let's try to think about, how can we use the LLMs to help us stitch together, you know, plans for analysis, not using the LLMs for analysis themselves.
Because what are the typical applications of what you're doing in industry or maybe in government? Where is all this relevant?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm honestly not the best person to answer that, because my focus is so, I get so caught up in, like, all right, well, what is the relationship between polygons and how do we define neighborhoods and adjacency and analyze these things, that I really personally struggle to think about use cases. I have a colleague on my team, Alberto, who is a wonderful person who talk about all these use cases. He goes to our Fed GIS conference every year in DC and helps present and talks to people from, like, I don't know, NOAA, FDA, whatever. And they're much better at discussing that. And I unfortunately am not. And that's really not my expertise. As much as I wish it were, it's not.
Well, fortunately, we cannot do everything. You know, that's a good thing, Josiah.
Yeah.
So let's jump into the other end of the pool, right? Because you have quite a number of R packages to your name, ArcGIS, GeoCode, ArcGIS Utils, SVDEP. There's the list goes on. And one of the things that you and I have talked about before is that you are introducing Rust for things that need to be speedy, right? Where perhaps before we would use C or C++. How did you get from R to Rust? What happened?
Yeah. So first and foremost, like, I've been programming in R since about 2015 now. So that's 10 years, which is crazy. And over that time, there's like this weird in the R and Python discourse, right? It's like, oh, R is so slow. And it's genuinely not. In many cases, it's actually faster than other interpretive languages, but there's that mythology around it. And I've always been like wanting to combat that. I don't know why it's like something that I feel responsible for, but it's just something that, you know, if I want to continue using this language, we have to prove its efficacy in that regard. And I tried a few times to learn C++ to do some, you know, computations that are faster and make my specifically geospatial analysis packages faster. So I have a package called SFDEP, which is a tidy binding to the SPDEP package. And through that, when I was teaching myself a lot of spatial stats, I wanted to implement new algorithms. And these algorithms were, frankly, pretty slow because, one, I was kind of naive in the approach, a lot of for loops, a lot of iteration, a lot of sampling. And I was like, well, C++ is a great way to do that. And I tried to learn RCPP and just failed miserably. I've tried like 4 or 5 times to learn C++ and I just couldn't get it. And then about October 2022, I've been watching like discourse around Rust a lot and seeing a lot of people talk about it. And people are saying it's a lot easier to learn because there's this thing called like the compiler that like tells you messages and things. And then I noticed that there is a project called Extender at the time, which, you know, provides a way to use Rust from R. And that was really kind of the motivation that I needed to try it out. And I started like teaching. The way I taught myself Rust was by creating a hobby project. So I used to play a lot of chess. Then I got really bad at it because I was concerned about losing. So I've stopped doing that since then. But one of the things that people use in chess is called FEN notation, which is a way to represent a position or a game. And I was like, well, maybe I can just parse FEN strings using Rust and, you know, create some representation of a chessboard in Rust. And I did do that. And looking back at the code, it's terrible, but it worked. And along that process, I learned that like, oh, Rust is actually a language that guides you to the right solution whenever you use it. Whereas when I was using C++, it's like blows up. You have no reason why. And that was really helpful for me to start using Rust. And then joining the Extender Discord channel, I could just ask questions. There's a lot of lovely humans there that were answering my own questions and helping me get to a place. And then I started writing for loops in Rust, and then I could call them from R, and I could just see how ridiculously fast they were. And that was kind of the motivation. And now I'm just kind of like so neck deep in Rust. I find it to be honestly more enjoyable than R sometimes for me, because there's just like an organization to it that I think is lacking elsewhere. But that's kind of how I found myself into Rust.
What I found in specifically with Rust, Josiah, is that somehow it's easier for me to just read through it, maybe because R is a functional language and, you know, Rust is a functional language, and it just makes so much more sense to me than other things that, yeah, I've seen before. But did you have that experience as well?
Yeah, I think one of the cool things about it is that as I started, like the key thing, at least for a data science perspective of using Rust, is we want to take some vector of information, we want to iterate through it and apply some transformation and collect the results into something else. And looking at the Rust code to do this, they don't have pipe operators, but they use method chaining. So you have a period, then a function name, period, then a function name, all on new lines. And you look at it, you have a vector and you have a dot iter, then you have a dot map, and then you have a dot collect. It's a lot like taking a vector in R, piping it to a mutate or some like L apply or something, piping it to a per map function. And then map automatically collects things. Rust doesn't collect things. It's two extra steps to say, I want to iterate and I want to collect. And you look at the code side by side, you're like, that looks like it could almost be R. And yes, this is R. And you're like, oh, well, that actually just feels good. It makes sense. It's natural. And there's like weird syntactical things that you have to figure out, like typing. But beyond that, like it's really straightforward, and you tell it what to do and it does the thing. And if anything goes wrong along the way, it'll tell you why it went wrong. And it just feels really nice. And most problems that people want to solve in R really come down to applying some operation over a vector. And if you just put that in Rust, it's probably a simple formula. And then you just can watch the performance speed up by like 100 times. And it's so simple.
It's good, because then I dare continue to advise people, you know, just learn R, because it prepares you for other languages like Rust, right? Just a way of thinking. So in the infrastructure and tools that you are using, right, there's a lot of pipeline around this. Tools in R are also getting better, but tools in Rust are known to be really great. But is there anything else in terms of infrastructure, tools, other languages perhaps that you are either fond of or that you need to use in your day-to-day?
Yeah, so I personally have been using the Zed editor for everything but R. And I'm working a pull request to make it so I could do R in Zed. It's a beautiful new IDE that's really more software developer oriented, but it's unbelievably fast. It's just beautiful. It's clean. You can kind of customize it a lot but it's not like other people who use like NeoVim or something like that. It feels like using VS Code, but just prettier. But beyond that, I've also been using something called Just, which I'm not sure if people have heard of. It's like a basically you have a file in your directory called Just File, and you give it commands. And you these are just like bash commands that are like git add or whatever. But I use that you can kind of customize them for your own project. And I use this all the time because I've just noticed there's things that I do all the time, which is like I run a code formatter. So I have a just format or I have a just check or something like that. And when you kind of have bigger projects where you have multiple steps that you might want to do, it's just like really nice to just go into your terminal, and I have my key binding set for Positron where I press command escape and it just goes straight to the terminal, and I can just type like just document, just develop or something like that. And it just does the thing. And I have to shout out Masa from the extender project who introduced me to it. I thought it was silly at first, but it's this weird time saver if you just spend 5 seconds up front.
I've been using it for years. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I think it's, you know, what's in a name? The name of this tool is just so appropriate. It's just so well thought out, you know, to just exactly. Do something. It's it's magical.
Yeah. I have that combined. I have this one project that is previously kind of secret right now, but part of it is I have to like automatically update things. Uh-huh. And I've combined that just file with something called watch exec. So I have something called just watch, and watch exec says, I'm going to run this command every time a file in this directory changes. And that I can just have that running in the background, and my website or whatever it is will just re-render. And I have to do nothing but save the file. And that is such a powerful combination. And it just like saves, you know, minutes each iteration, and those minutes turn to hours over the course of a day.
I wanted to go back, so I don't want to interrupt if you're in the flow of
the conversation,
but I remember, now that you were talking about what you've done in our studio opposite with the government sector, right?
Yeah.
Anything that you could comment on adoption of R, what you learned, the good, bad things of government and data? We have a similar past on that end. That's why I want to get your points of view.
Yeah, I'm a few years disconnected from that, but it was a really good time and a really interesting time. I got to work with a bunch of government organizations, particularly in the US and the Department of Defense, to help them kind of adopt and use R in their ecosystems. And what I found really interesting is people didn't really need any motivation to use R, they just wanted to. They have these people called ORSAs, operational research analysts, and a lot of them are just using R, and a lot of people turn to R because it's so quick, it's so helpful, and like getting from zero to efficient using R is not that hard. It's like a couple hours of, you know, R for data science. But the biggest problem there, and I think this is just generally true of just larger organizations, is the bureaucracy in it. And there's these people that are responsible for kind of infrastructure, and these tend to be IT people. And often you'll hear people say, oh, well, I'm not allowed to install R. I'm not allowed to install R packages. And then people will just stop there. They'll just say, oh, someone told me no, and I'm just going to listen to them. For better or for worse, I don't like being told no, and I have a problem with authority. So
I'm going to go.
Well, no, it's not just like, no, it's, well, why? Because, uh-huh. Well, because it's not an answer. So you run it up the pipe, and more than anything, it's just a misunderstanding about what this thing is. So spending some time with people and helping them understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish and how it's already similar to other things that they already have in their ecosystem, because I assure you, they're already using Python somewhere. And just trying to make these comparisons and see, okay, well, how can we work with you to make this feel like something that's comfortable for you? And doing that alone, I think, is like a huge win. A lot of times it's like, okay, well, we need to centralize the R installations. We're going to have our own offline, you know, R packages. And then once we have our offline R packages, you can install from there and do whatever the hell you want. So I think it's a lot of times it's being willing, And I think this is just outside of government too. You need to be willing to kind of go up against the stream and be willing to ask why, and then make people voice their disagreements with real points. And then a lot of times it also, like, you have to do it nicely, right? You don't have to say you're wrong. And getting people to kind of like walk themselves through the solution too. And I think that's really, really important.
You know, I was asking because we have, and I usually hear France, R allows that zero to woe much faster, which is what you just said at the beginning of this answer, Isaiah. And we've had similar experiences with governments, people that want to do things, sometimes simple things, but they are working with data all day. They come from just using Excel and then jumping into R and then starting using stuff, doing things make sense. It's simple. And then that allows for a next level of innovation in government as well.
Yeah. I mean, the ggplot gateway drug is very real. my fiance, she's not really into programming, but she is into making pretty plots. And she, you know, has to use data for work. And every once in a while, she'll have to bring it in and she'll just throw it right into ggplot. And the automatic, like, whoa from colleagues is, it's impressive. And it's like, it doesn't take that much. It just takes a few hours of pain and learning. But with most things, you know, to grow is a little painful. But once you're there, like, the amount of knowledge you need to make a good ggplot is not much. And the ROI is huge. It's huge.
Look, and now that you talked about government, which is, if you want, one of the most traditional sites, then you talk about companies like RStudio and Esri now. And then we go to what's going on today in the AI space, where you have brutal valuations that we've never seen. Companies raising at $150 billion valuations and whatever, right? So, and by the way, you also have a good context there where LLMs, I loved your answer, like, for the right thing. We're not analyzing data. And we, by the way, been asked by customers, hey, can we do this and let an LLM do all the analysis? No, you cannot. And then we're like, nice, right? So I would like for us here and to get your perspective on what you see in the AI space today, from the computer exaggerations to what are the real use case you find, the cool companies that you're seeing.
Yeah. So my use of AI is genuinely quite limited, because that's not true. I use AI like every day. It's honestly been like a force multiplier for me in what I can do and how quickly I can accomplish it. Like right now, I, for example, am reading through a paper from few months ago that goes over graph convolutional neural networks. I didn't know anything about graph convolutional neural networks on Monday, but I've been able to sit down with Claude, go through the paper, take screenshots, ask him to compare, you know, parts of this thing to my existing knowledge. And it's been really helpful for me to kind of like have a study part. I think of Claude and ChatGPT as my own personal tutor that I can ask directed questions to, and that can provide me mostly pretty good answers all the time. But it's not hard to become more expert in some subject than Claude or ChatGPT. At that point, it's nice because you can say, no, you're wrong. But I think the danger is when people view AI or these LLMs as like semi-deities of all-knowing prowess or knowledge, whatever, and relying on it to do everything for you. And there's this stance that's kind of coming up that I think is really important. We started seeing this like a few years ago with the massive drop in answers on Stack Overflow, right? Like, tons of people were responding to Stack Overflow, then LLMs started coming around, then poof, it's like down in the dirt. If ChatGPT and Claude can only regurgitate what they've seen from other humans, and we're now only using ChatGPT and Claude to kind of create new packages or new things, we're kind of just going to be in this self-reinforcing cycle of non-innovation, right? We're just going to be going down known paths. And I think being able to have that domain expertise to guide these LLMs to help you through your answer is super important. And it's very easy to kind of relinquish control back to the LLM and say, yeah, just like go code and do stuff. But then you find yourself in a world of hurt because it's done a terrible job. It looks like it works at first, but the more you dive into it, it's so broken and it needs hours of fixing. So just like, I think of it as like a personal tutor. And also if you want it to build things for you, it requires a lot of active energy to babysit it.
Lovely. And I guess, and probably you cannot comment on this one, but I can also see that as companies like S3 or CRMs or ERPs or system solutions, right, that do cool things for users.
Yeah.
I think that then having this as an interface that allows you to maybe have more human-like interaction instead of maybe going through very complex old style interfaces, that's another way where, yeah, there may be new value, right, of using all these elements that, as you said, are trained on text and then they can help interpretation and all this stuff.
I think that the view that I've leaned towards is we should absolutely never think of these things as a humanistic thing. I think we should think of them as interactive. I don't want to talk to a person. I want to talk to the documents, right? Like I want something to say, oh, go look over there, or here, I'll help you find the answer. I don't want someone greeting me or saying hi, you know. Once we start like anthropomorphizing these things too much, it becomes scary. But yeah, I agree. It's a way for us to have kind of an automatic response to getting help. It's kind of like hitting the dopamine button a little bit, but I think it is really good.
Fantastic, lovely. Franz, before we jump into the usual question of how Josiah learned from what he's doing and all the world, and any other technical one that you have that you want to go for it before we go there.
No, maybe not now. There's so many. just if anybody's listening, there's get the list of all the packages that Josiah has worked on, because there's some really cool stuff and it's a long list.
I would just say, ahead, please.
No,
please,
go for it.
I was going to be a total non sequitur.
No, then on that end, your motivation for different packages and what you're doing and how you work on those, if you could, because we usually see a lot of our work and our customers' work around, okay, let's build a package and then all that goes around that. If you could talk about that now that Franz gave me that cool intro, that would be awesome.
Yeah, and that actually goes towards what I wanted to say anyways. So the question really is like, what motivates a package and why would I develop it? And I think this also goes back towards to what I said about I am a contrarian a bit. And also another belief that I have is that there are not enough R developers. I think we have too many R users and not enough people willing to take ownership and say, this is a problem I see in the world and I want to fix it. Or I want to try to solve it. And that's where a lot of my package development has really stemmed from, is there's something that I want. It doesn't exist, or it doesn't exist in the way that I want it to. How do I do so? My first package, I really wanted to do, I was learning about sentiment analysis and NLP from the wonderful Tidy NLP book. And I really, really wanted to do an analysis on Kendrick Lamar's album, Damn, which had just come out in like 2016 or 2017. And there was no programmatic way to get the lyrics. So I spent like 5 days in my uncle's like basement apartment thing. And he was like, what, are you okay? And I came out and showed him this R package I wrote called Genius R, which you could type in an artist's name, a song, and get the lyrics back to you. And that was awesome. And then similarly, right, like this package I wrote called SFDEP, which is a tidy interface to SPDEP. I really wanted to be able to use the spatial analysis functions from the SPDEP package, which is brilliant, by the way, in a dplyr tidyverse-centric way. I was told no by the developer on GitHub. So naturally, if I'm told no, well, how do I make it happen? And you figure out how this works locally and you say, okay, well, how do I generalize that? How would I make this possible for other people to use also? And that's where a package comes in. And I really think like, if you have a problem and you figure out how to solve it for you, think about how you could parameterize it essentially and make it available to other people and help them solve their problems. So I really think if you can write a function, you can write an R package, and learning how to write a function is not hard. Learning how to write good functions is hard, but the entry is not. And I think we need to have a lot more people, when they solve their own problem, think about, well, can I impact other people who may have the same problem as me? Can I generalize this solution and put it into an R package, and don't put a capital R at the end of the R package? People won't use it. and just kind of like share about it. Like, you know, share that you've done this thing, make like one post to R Weekly or a skeet or a tweet or a post on LinkedIn or whatever. And then maybe some people will see it, depending on how much you evangelize it, but at least it's out there in the ether for someone to Google and maybe accidentally stumble upon.
I like that so much, Josiah. There's one thing I'd like to add, if I may. And yeah, that is that if you see something you can fix, fix it. I have mm-hmm. learned so much, and I've gained so much, how do you call that? This feeling where you can contribute.
Yeah.
By simply fixing things, and then somebody saying, you know, they merge the pull request and say thanks, and it can be something as small as a typo, but suddenly yeah. you're part of something larger, and it really is an amazing feeling. It's scary at first, but once you get over that barrier, you know, it's really massive, because you suddenly find yourself part of something bigger. And usually, for anybody listening and considering this, people developing R packages are as nice as Josiah, so don't be scared. You know, you'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Yeah, and I think also, like, it is super empowering to be able to say, "Hey, I did this thing," and you could see it in the news.md or something. But also, like, I know for me, for example, there are tons of things that I want to accomplish in way too many R packages, but I just don't have the bandwidth to do it. And a lot of them aren't hard. I just am not going to do it right now. And I may never do it. But if someone else comes and does it, at least attempts to do it, creates a pull request, and the pull request should have a good description. It should justify why they've done it. And here's the approach. It's so much easier for me to go through that pull request and say, hey, can you fix XYZ? Can you add a check here? Can you do this, that, or the other? And then they're like, oh, wonderful, great. And then, you know, maybe we can get that thing fixed and merged within a couple of days or weeks, and everyone benefits, you know? And it's not, I think people are a little afraid. I don't think people feel empowered enough in the R ecosystem. Lacks a level of arrogance that other ecosystems have. And I think that's good, but also it's a weakness too, because people don't approach things saying, I can be the solution. They might view other people as the experts. And if it hasn't been done before, there's a reason. The reason probably is they just didn't want to, or they didn't have time, or they didn't think about it. And you could just suggest it and do it. And the worst thing that happens is someone says no. Like, that's okay. It's happened to me many times. and I just encourage people to at least give it a shot.
Agreed.
My father used to say, I don't know when I get emotional here, but if everybody spent a couple hours a week doing something for others, the world would be a much better place. Plus, if you had the hacker mentality that you mentioned now, which is, hey, let's go solve things. No. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go even more. So,
yeah,
those two things, thinking community and thinking hacker mentality, really adds so much value, so much value.
Yeah, and I will even say, on the total opposite end of the kind and community-oriented approach, there's something I also have heard referred to as spite-driven development, where if someone tells you no or you can't do something, you'd be surprised how good of a motivator that could be to get something done. Just remember to publish it. And it's okay if you do it because of spite. Just share it with the community.
Fantastic. Look, Josiah, this is a fantastic turned into a very, very cool conversation. I liked it. We usually ask, how do you keep up on what you're doing? In your case, Geo, then Rust, then R. Which people do you follow? What do you read? Where do you go for conferences? What is your way of keeping up to date and being in the crest of the wave?
I don't go to conferences. They're far too expensive for me. But I also, it's been harder actually. So I deleted my Twitter. which was a tough thing to do, but I did that. It's really good for my mental health, I will tell you. So if you're considering doing it, you should. So the way I get my news is, or my news, my tech news, I guess, is actually a little behind now. I use Reddit a lot for this, but I don't use Reddit for R-related things. I don't really find myself as intrigued by new R develops as I used to be. I'm much more on the side of like, how can I bring things from other ecosystems to the R ecosystem? A lot of that really is on the side of Rust. But from geospatial, I really recommend following Kyle Barron. He is a Rust and Python developer behind Longboard. He's taught me so many things. I think a lot of us should try to look at the work he's brought to the Python ecosystem and say, how do we bring it to the R ecosystem? And honestly, I think the best thing that's been happening for me is I've been in these Discord groups. I'm in the Extender Discord group. They'll share stuff. I'm in the Geo Rust Discord group. I'm in other ones, and that's a place that I really go to for that kind of stuff. And I don't know. I had something else that I wanted to say, but it's just totally vanished out of my mind. But So for more geospatial stuff, at least for the spatial stats related things, I like following Levi Wolf, Danny Arribas. These are all people that kind of develop in the libpySal world. But they're exceptionally kind and really smart people and are very open to sharing things. But yeah, I guess like I don't really get my news as much as I used to, which is, I think, good for me.
You were in the Rust conference, if I recall correctly. You met Andres.
Yeah.
Friends there. And you mentioned a lot of things that you do. I mean, just being in all this Reddit world, by the way, deleting Twitter, I think it's, something healthy for a lot of people. So I completely agree with you. But Discord groups and being able to continue developing things and then getting feedback from people that are using those packages, I think it's a fantastic way of keeping doing interesting and relevant stuff for a community. Josiah, we got to the end. We have to usually keep this to maximum of 40 minutes episodes, but this was fantastic. I really loved the conversation. So thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Bye. Take care.
Till next time.
All right.
Gracias por acompañarnos en nuestra exploración del mundo de ciencia de datos en este Data Latam Podcast. Cada dos semanas encontrarás un nuevo episodio en datalatam.com o iTunes. Si te gustó este podcast, déjanos comentarios en Facebook.